Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. I hope my voice holds up. It's the last day of the meetings. Anyway, I'm going to talk about position balanced designs, which is really also spatially balanced designs, and I will explain later why these two terms might be appropriate. It's something actually I've been working on for now about 35 years, and I'll explain sort of the journey to you a little bit later. So quick outline. I'll talk a little bit about spatial variability, non-stationarity, and randomization, basically why we have a problem or a challenge, I should say. The effects of spatial variability on the outcome of experiments. A design-based solution, a relatively simple solution, which is spatial balancing within the context of block designs. And then the implementation. So just to review a little bit what the issue is. So the most basic purpose of randomization is to remove bias, even accidental bias, from treatment effects, and then to obtain unbiased estimates of the error. Of course, we're using the error as a standard to evaluate effects of treatments. So we are using this very extensively because of Fisher, who sort of won all the battles around how you do experiments. And so he heavily promoted the concept of randomization, and then using replication and possibly local control, which is basically blocking. But there were others, including Student, who promoted balance, balance against possible trends. And then Jeffrey, sort of in the late 30s, basically said, well, we should probably do both. We should eliminate the larger systematic effects as accurately as possible, and then randomize the rest, which is basically what randomized complete block designs are. So you're using the blocks are basically an inherent acknowledgement of non-stationarity, and then you still randomize within that. So we do, as you know, we typically have a lot of problems with non-stationarity. We can have spatial autocorrelations, we can have trends in fields, we can have periodicity, and those are the most common ones. And so that means that the underlying variability is not really random. So this assumption of independent and identically distributed random variables typically doesn't hold in field experiments, right? And so that's we can assume that, but it's often not quite the case. Let me go back to this. So where I started this journey was when I was a master student at Iowa State University, and I was a student in soil physics. And the soil physics community at the time in the early 80s became very interested in spatial variability. So and geostatistics, and we all looked at variograms and that kind of thing. But there was mostly focused on observational data. So there was no treatments involved. So, and my thinking was, well, you know, that it must also impact experiments, right? So I started to look into that, learned that a lot of other people had thought about that, of course, and that it was difficult to really improve on that. But this is sort of the problem. Peter, you probably recognize these images. The Iowa Soybean Association and the On-Farm Network published these wonderful images of fields. So you have here a situation where you have RGB and the false color and the DVI images. The point here is the underlying variability. And so if you try to conduct an experiment like the On-Farm Network does, typically these are strip trials, you may not have a lot of flexibility in terms of how you can lay those out. Often the direction of the equipment is predefined. So you have this kind of a situation that if these are three blocks, three reps of some kind of an experiment, let's say they involve five or six treatments, maybe it's an N-rate experiment, whatever. You know, you can see the problems that you run into, but this is an NDVI image. This is something that you find out after the fact. You know, in a different year, you might have a very different variability pattern. If you were to lay it out this way, here are the blocks, you would still have the same problem that you have not only variability maybe among the different reps or blocks, but you have this variability within. It's whether it's a trend or autocorrelation. And typically you don't know that a priori, so it's difficult to deal with. So when we look at randomized complete block designs, then we have potentially a number of challenges. So when you think about a design like this, it's 6 treatments, 4 reps, you have a very large number, thousands of possible outcomes of a randomization exercise. If you think about all the permutations of where each of these treatments could be, right? And so many of these designs are maybe not as good as other designs. So if you look at this design, right, and you are, say, on a field like I saw, showed before, what would be some of the problems that you would have with this design? Anybody see anything jumping out at them? If you have a trend or spatial autocorrelation. Yeah? Yeah, treatment number 6. Very good, very good. Treatment number 6 tends to be on the right side, right, or east side, or whatever that is. So that would be kind of a concern, right? You would prefer to have that balance. You don't want it always sort of be on one side of the block. All right, so that's very good. You get a star for that. There's another issue here, and that's basically the distance among the treatments. So treatments 1 and 2 are adjacent here, adjacent there, and there's only one in between, right? I mean, you wouldn't easily see that, you know, because it's not as obvious. But treatment 1 versus 6 tends to be further apart from each other, all right? And so if you have spatial autocorrelation, that can create some problems, all right? So what is that problem? So if we just look at one block, right, and we have 6 treatments, then treatment 1 and 2 are close together, so under the under the null hypothesis, you would have very low variability here, variance between them. But 1 and 6 are on the opposite ends, and so if you have a trend or spatial autocorrelations, then you're more likely to have treatment effects, just simply because they're farther apart from each other. You know, if you were to have a semivariogram, you'd know that you would have higher expected variability, right? So that means that the short distance contrast, so 1 and 2 or 2, 3, whatever, has a higher probability of a type 2 error, and a long distance contrast a higher probability of a type 1 error. Or in other words, you're more likely to find significant differences between 1 and 6 than you would be between 1 and 2. Now, of course, the way you remedy that is through replication, right? So it's not that likely that 1 and 6 will be on the opposite ends again in the next block or the next block, but this process is imperfect. So randomization doesn't explicitly account for this problem, right? So about 10 years later, I kind of revisited it. I was in my pre-tenure years, and I thought, I need another paper to get over the tenure hurdle. I'm going to go revisit this stuff, right? And so so we looked at, you know, so what's really the problem? What's the spatial nature of randomization, right? So by not explicitly accounting or balancing for these spatial effects, what's really the problem? So one of the things we worked out sort of mathematically, you know, what's the mean distance of comparison, right? So going back to this is the distance of comparison, H. What's the mean for different treatments? So it's basically the mean goes up if you have more treatments in your block. That makes sense, right? You need more space if you have more treatments given the same plot size. Then the variance, which is really the discrepancy among the distance of comparison, also goes up when you have more treatments, right? But it is reduced by the number of replications, right? So the more replications you have, the less likely you have a problem. But you look at a typical scenario, this is 4 treatments, 4 reps, you still have a lot of discrepancy in terms of the distance of comparison. Even though most are maybe, you know, at this average, there are some treatments that, like the 1 versus 6 or the 1 versus 2, that sort of fall on the one side or another. And so if you have more treatments, this is 9 treatments and 4 reps, you still have quite a few of those experiments that, or treatment contrast that would be on those ends, right? So you would have that problem. So the other thing that we did is we went back to this Mercer and Hall data set, which is quite a famous data set, 1911, the Rothamsted Experiment Station. It was a wheat uniformity trial. And so you can use that to sort of look at the, so you basically have the null hypothesis there, it's a uniformity trial. So we simulated and randomized complete block design with 9 treatments and 4 reps on that, and we did 50 randomizations. In those days, 50 randomizations was a lot. Nowadays, you would do 10,000, right? So this is a uniformity trial. So no hypothesis. There were no treatment effects, right? So we looked at the error variance, and so for the long distance comparison, so that subset that was on the average longer distance, so basically these guys here, right? The error variance was 51% higher, right? So it's somewhat to be expected. So that meant that if you were making a contrast, that if you thought you were testing at the 1% error level, you were actually testing at the 3%. Or if you thought you were testing at the 5% level, you were actually doing it at the 9% level, right? So that's a little bit of a problem with some of those. So, but there are solutions, and those solutions have been proposed a long time ago, of course. There's incomplete blocks. I mean, that's the whole point of incomplete blocks, is you just make the blocks smaller so you have less of a problem. Of course, there's a downside to that because you lose degrees of freedom, and it's a little bit more complicated to analyze, certainly in those days. Nearest neighbor designs, that's also one solution. Trend analysis, or some of this work from Fagrut and van Merwen, equalizing variances. But it's not, these are sort of kind of exceptional cases, right? So one of the things that we decided to do, so you can look at the dates here, so it was about 15 years ago. We said, well, what do people actually use? What do agronomists or soil scientists or crop scientists or breeders, what kind of designs do they use? So I asked a graduate student to go through the agronomy journal. This is the paper version in those days. So he literally kind of went through every paper in the agronomy journal for these 3 volumes, you know, 2001 through 2003. And I asked him to identify in the method section, what the nature of the experiment was, and then what kind of a design that they used. So just to get a sense of what people do. There's all these alternatives out there, but are they actually using them? So out of the 537, there were 414 that were field-based, and the rest were something else, greenhouse lab, whatever. So we said, okay, we'll focus on that because we're talking about field variability. And then let's look within that, how many of those are different types of designs. So 298 out of those were randomized complete block designs, right, that what we're talking about. And then there's a number of other ones. Sometimes there was no an unknown main plot arrangement, if it was a split plot. There were a number of them, actually, that were unknown design. I don't know how they got published, but you do wonder. So there were a couple of completely randomized designs, and then a couple of incomplete block designs, and then one Latin square design. But what that means, so if you take out sort of the ones that were unknown or were irrelevant, like they were a sampling or survey, that meant that basically 97% of the field experiments with a known design were RCBDs. So we concluded that's what agronomists like, right? We do RCBDs. And I don't think that has changed, basically. I think it's mostly being done that way. Okay, so if that's what people use, then we should maybe try to optimize those designs. So one way to do that is to do spatial balance, right? And the idea was like, well, let's design spatially optimized experiments or experimental designs, and then that are insensitive to field trends or spatial correlation or periodicity. And then the idea is that you then randomly allocate the treatments to those. So there's still a randomization component, but you start out with basically an optimized design. So think of it as you have many, say this is 6 treatments and 4 reps, you have many potential outcomes of designs. You kind of eliminate the bad ones and you keep a set of good designs. And so there's still a randomization component, so you still have many possible outcomes, but at least they're spatially balanced. So for example, treatment six here, you can see, is basically spatially balanced, right? And also the distances are spatially balanced. Okay, so we then decided to, so this is actually, and now we're 10 years later again, we got some money, and I contacted some computer scientists and said, you know, how do we do this? And so we decided to develop these spatial balances because we pointed out the problem, we didn't have a solution. And so basically we developed spatially balanced designs for complete block designs that promoted spatial balance among treatment contrasts, so that 1 versus 2, 1 versus 6, that you get away from that problem. But it would also disallow treatments to occur in the same position in different blocks. So for example, this problem that we have with treatment 6 being in the same position or being in the same area, that you would eliminate that as well. Okay, so that you would balance for the position within a block. So we used a method of simulated annealing based on the approach of the traveling tournament problem, and we had basically an objective function that looked at the average distance. We tried to balance the average distance between treatment contrast, and we tried to balance the position, so we would disallow a treatment to be in the same position like a Lawton square. Okay, so just to give you a sense of how the simulated annealing works, so you have some kind of an objective function. In fact, we had two in our case. And simulated annealing is kind of a naive approach, a very kind of numerical approach, where you you start out with the design, and then you you kind of have a search neighborhood within that, and then you change the design a little bit, you tweak it, then you evaluate whether the new design is better than the old design. If it's better, then you keep it, and then you try again, and you try to see if you can improve it again. So slowly, you work your way towards an optimum design, just by tweaking it every time. Okay, so so this is just a simplified version of that. So now we were trying to minimize the variance in terms of the average distance of comparison. So we generated spatially balanced complete block designs for 100 treatments and 20 blocks. So that sort of covers the vast majority, probably, of the designs that are being used. It was a huge computational requirement, especially this is about 12 years ago. We kept the cluster at the computer science department at Cornell humming for about 2 weeks. It was because it's a kind of a naive approach, and so it's a lot of computation. And then the larger designs, larger than 100 by 20, were basically very difficult to develop because it's very difficult to get the convergence because you're looking at so many possible outcomes. Okay, but 120, that's a lot of designs. So just to give you some results, so here's a 6 by 6 design, and you look, for example, at treatment number 1. You see it's here, there, 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 and there. So it's position balanced like in a Lawton square, right? But also there's an average balancing of the distances among the treatments, right? So on the average for all the reps, it's basically balanced. And so this is a square design, and so a spatially balanced square design is a Lawton square. But a Lawton square is not necessarily spatially balanced. So it's a subset of Lawton squares that are spatially balanced. So, but this is just a square design. We're looking at many other designs as well. But if you do have a square design, then you can get perfect spatial balance in the cases where n modulus 3 does not equal 1. So 2 by 2 designs, 3 by 3, 5 by 5, 6 by 6. So we know now sort of theoretically when you get perfect balance. So here's another example. We had a little web interface that did these like nice little colors that shows you these. This is a 5 by 5 design. Shows you that, and then you could click on another option where you could look at the spatial balance. So in this case, this 5 by 5 design, it's all green. It means that it's perfectly spatially balanced. Okay, so that because that was possible, because the design is not that big. Here's a larger design, 15 by 10. Now look also, there's a lot of interest, actually, Peter Kavarika and I were talking about it. doing sort of ex post, maybe spatial analysis or something like that, then it's also nice to have your treatment sort of well distributed over a field. So this is the 10 by 15 by 10, and here's the spatial balance. It's not absolutely perfect. It's just too difficult to find absolutely perfect balance, but it's very good. It's just slightly less than perfect. So we published that in 2007, and this Geoderma article, and there's two tables in there that basically show these designs. I know the letters are very small, but here's like five blocks and eight treatments, and that's then a spatially optimized design. This is the first table, and then the second table is 11 to 15 treatments. So that's all that we could fit into a table in a journal article, but we went all the way to 100 treatments and 20 reps, and you can imagine that would make a very, very big table. But this is what was out there. The other thing that we did is I had a number of extension agents and agronomists who had a copy of that table in their wallet. So I just say, well, I can just make a little wallet card, you know, that has these designs on them, right? So if somebody wants to design an experiment, here it is, right? And that's also it's on the web. You can find it. So if you had a design with four reps and 10 treatments, then that's where you are. You just randomly allocate your treatments to the design. So more recently, I ended up communicating with Steve Gilling at Gilling Data Management. Actually, Steve is right there in the back of the room. And so they have the ARM software that's widely used by universities and also many of the corporations that do product testing and all that. And so he became interested in this idea because it's a problem that many people deal with. And so last year they put in some diagnostic tools basically to look at distance of comparison as part of the design features of the software. So you can see that here on the left, you know, there's this information. You can look at average distances, and there's a number of other very, very neat diagnostic tools. But in next year's edition, they're going to be incorporating all these spatially balanced designs. So I gave Gilling all of my designs, and they're available to anybody. And so now you have the option. I think you just click here, and then you get a spatially balanced design. So now, basically, everybody who uses this software, and it's a lot of companies and universities and researchers, they now have ready access to this. So, in conclusion, and this is not my last slide, by the way, I still have one more surprise. So traditional randomized designs provide basically inadequate protection against non-stationary fields. And you can expect a field to be non-stationary. I have never seen a uniform field or a field that doesn't have some type of non-stationary like autocorrelations or trends. If you have, then let me know. I'd like to see that field. The great majority of the agronomic field experiments are still implemented as RCBDs. That's just what people use. And actually, that's what I use too. I mean, it's still very attractive. So we developed these spatially balanced designs to protect against that. And now the ARM software basically includes that. So last slide. My title was position balanced designs, not spatially balanced design. I've always used spatially balanced design until recently. You know, if you're on ResearchGate, probably many of you are, you get these notifications if somebody cited your work. So I got this notification from a paper. Basically, these are musicologists, and they had they cited our work on this. And what they did is it says we investigated the influence of the musical characteristics of tempo, mode, and percussiveness on emotions of people. And they brought in a panel, 32 participants. And then they had them listen to 16 pop songs and 16 rock songs, and then they would measure all kinds of indicators of emotions and all that. And so I was like, well, why would these people be using that? Well, it makes sense. So in this case, the participant is a block, because each participant was exposed to all these different songs, right? But you can imagine that if you first listen to, say, the Rolling Stones and then the Carpenters, that's different than if you first listen to the Carpenters and then the Rolling Stones, right? They weren't actually using those, but so they were concerned about that balancing, that the sequence mattered, right? Because there's obviously a temporal correlation. If you've listened to one thing first, that would obviously affect your emotions to the next song, or maybe three songs down. So the treatments were basically the position balancing of the song. So this is not spatial balancing, but it's exactly the same thing. So now I'm kind of revisiting the terminology. Maybe we should call it position balancing instead of spatial balancing, so that we're more generalized. Okay, so thanks very much. It's been a very interesting journey for me. Like I said, I started this as a master's student at Iowa State 35 years ago, and I'm really I'm very grateful that the Gilling folks are now incorporating that into their software, and that it becomes more widely available beyond the little wallet card, which is still useful. Anyway, thanks very much.
Thank you.